Our topic tonight is the relation between religion and state as conceived of by some of the central medieval Jewish thinkers. We're going to focus tonight on the Rambam, Rabbeinu Nissim of Gerona, and Rabbi Isaac Abravanel. I'll talk about each of them in turn, and then after I've done that, try to dig a little deeper into Rabbeinu Nissim, who I think in a lot of ways holds a lot of potential that later Jewish thinkers will exploit. And I should say here, I'm really summarizing the work of several prominent scholars of medieval Jewish thought. If this means anything, Avi Revitsky, Zev Harvey, Jerry Blitstein, Menachem Lorberbaum, it's very little that I'm going to say tonight that is actually original to me, if anything. The question of religion and state and the possibility, impossibility of the separation of powers. We'll start with Rambam, Maimonides. As you know, this is 12th century, 1138 to 1204, we think. And the most well-known paradigm we have for thinking about religion and state in the Middle Ages is the one associated with Maimonides, for whom full unification of religion and state is the ideal. Now, Maimonides wears a lot of hats, you know, in the perspective of Jewish thought. The greatest halachist of the Middle Ages, the greatest philosopher of the Middle Ages. I think you can also say the greatest Jewish political theorist, or at least the major political theorist in the history of the Jewish people, right? The most influential for sure. And it's important, though, to bear in mind that as with many other issues, Maimonides casts such a large shadow that it's easy to forget that he's not the only one with an opinion on many of these central issues. And here again, you know, it's an important thing to emphasize, he is not the only Jewish political theorist. And in fact, we're going to spend substantial time on Rabbeinu Nissim as a really important alternative to what Maimonides has bequeathed us. I think you can say that a starting point for thinking about his approach to politics is that there's a fundamental tension in the human condition. On the one hand, following Aristotle, Maimonides argues that the human being is a political animal who is dependent on society and needs a collective in order to function, let alone flourish. So we need a state of some kind. And yet, on the other hand, although all human beings share some rational capacity, they also have emotions and imagination. In those things, we differ very dramatically one from the other. And as we know, human beings can behave in ways that are wildly irrational and extremely destructive. So the question that a philosopher and a prophet both need to answer is, how do we rein in this destructive side of human nature? And for Maimonides, the answer to that question is essentially that there are two means by which we rein in the ways that emotion and imagination can run wild. One is law, and the other is leadership. One is law, and the other is leadership. The law and the leader both work to unify society and help realize their kind of social, political nature. And how does that work? Well, it's crucial to understand that for Maimonides, both institutions, law and leadership, are conceived in profoundly religious terms. We need a divine law, and we need prophetic leadership. So let's talk for a minute about what divine law is in the Middle Ages. For Rambam, what distinguishes divine law from human law is not really where it comes from, but rather what its purpose is. Or if you want to speak the language of medieval philosophy, what its telos is, what it is in the world to accomplish. Human law aims only at the welfare of human life in one domain, and that is the political domain. It helps us get along. David Lowenfeld and I want to kill each other, and the law says, no, stop, behave yourself. But a divine law, in contrast, does have that aim, but also another one, right? It aims at the education of people a struggle with whether we should say the education of man. I want to be inclusive, but I also want to be medieval. So it's difficult. So we'll say here the education of men so that they can achieve religious and intellectual perfection. In a famous and extremely influential chapter in the Moreh Nevuchim, in the Guide of the Perplexed, the Rambam talks about the law of the Torah as aimed both at tikkun haguf and tikkun hanefesh. I really am never sure how to translate tikkun from medieval Hebrew, but let's say, I don't know, the perfection of the body and the perfection of the soul. The perfection of the body is first in time, but the perfection of soul is first in value. So that's where we start. And by the way, as Avi Ravitsky points out, right, it is only the integration and unification of the political and the theological that makes the law divine. One without the other would not be divine law. Divine law needs to be both of these things together. And that's why, this is Avi Ravitsky's argument, the Mishneh Torah, Maimonides' Code of Law, begins with a series of teachings about ideas, about philosophical ideas, because the Rambam wants to make clear he's not just a posek, a decisor of human law. He's a posek, a decisor of divine law. That is law that aims to perfect the entirety of the human and not just our ability to live together politically. Now, so that's the law piece. And in terms of leadership, what distinguishes a prophet from any other political leader is that the prophet integrates these two realms just as the law does. A political leader keeps David and me from killing each other. A prophetic leader keeps me and David from killing each other, but also helps us grow towards a greater intellectual and moral realization, of our capacity. The messenger that God sends, the prophet, brings together political abilities with knowledge of God. By the way, there are interesting similarities that are probably obvious to some of you between what Maimonides is saying about the prophet and what Plato says about the philosopher king. That is to say, someone who brings together the perfection of mind and the ability to govern. For Rambam, when he looks back in history, the Jewish people had this in the past. They had Moshe, they had Yehoshua, they had the judges. And he says they will have it again in the messianic future. They will have leaders who fully integrate the political with the intellectual spiritual. Interestingly, as Ravitsky points out, this leads Maimonides to ignore the traditional distinction between the Messiah, son of Joseph, who's understood to be a military and political leader, and the Messiah, son of David, who's understood to be a religious and spiritual leader. Because for Maimonides, you actually can't separate those two. Those two, on some level, have to be one. There needs to be one redemptive figure who embodies them both. Now, if you're thinking about where I said I wanted to start with religion and state slash the separation of powers, you might already realize that Maimonides is not off to a promising start for us, right? This is really about precisely the refusal of separating religion from state power. Now, we have, though, in classical Judaism, both a king and a prophet. So what's the relationship between them? So Rambam understands that in reality, right, in Jewish history, very often the tasks of the prophet and the king were separated. And in fact, as we've seen, the prophets were willing to lambast the kings when it seemed appropriate. But this still does not lead him to say, oh, king and prophet are separate, therefore what we have is separation of powers, separation of the theological from the political. Quite the contrary, what Maimonides ends up doing is suggesting that the prophet has a key political dimension to what he's doing, and the king has a key religious one. That is to say, even when it seems that there might be separate spheres, it's the job of Maimonides, if you will, to blur that wall and to sort of suggest that each one spills over into the other domain. What do I mean by that very concretely? The prophet. What distinguishes a prophet from a philosopher? Unlike the philosopher, the prophet has a powerful imagination and therefore can use stories, parables, and images to inspire and lead people who are not the absolute elite. right? The prophet, in other words, has charisma. The prophet can give a dramatic speech. Think about the greatest political orators you've ever heard and the way they're able to kind of stir people's imagination about how they might live. And again, the combination of knowledge of God and political abilities is what elevates him to the status of prophet. Remember, both the leader and the law have to combine the political with the theological. Now, politics alone, though, cannot truly enable people to live well together, because you need prophecy and the divine spirit, because most people are not going to be moved by abstract philosophical ideas. And conversely, philosophy alone can't hold people together, because rational argument is not what motivates many people, right? The wider public, people need myths, stories, and what Maimonides talks about as necessary beliefs, which in a seminar on Maimonides, we would talk about how necessary beliefs is not a synonym for true beliefs. That is why Avram fails and Moshe succeeds, because Moshe is a prophet and Avram is a philosopher. Avram doesn't know how to build a polis, whereas Moshe does. The prophet essentially serves to teach the truth partially to the masses and fully to the elite. But he also creates myths and popular beliefs that hold society together. As for the king has a religious function. As Maimonides says in the Laws of Kings, you have this on your source sheet, everything the king does should be for the sake of heaven, and he should elevate the true religion. Kolam asav yu l'shem shamayim, v'tehye megamato makshavto l'harim dat ha'emet. The king is not a religious legislator. He's not a halachist, but he is tasked with more than maintaining the political order. He has to create the conditions that will encourage people to pursue spiritual perfection, which consists of the knowledge of God. Essentially, some version of a constitutional monarchy. You can look at the second source in Maimonides there. So in other words, for Maimonides, the state serves religion, and religion serves the state. The state serves religion in that the king is subject to the Torah. He makes the Torah's laws the laws of the state, and he, quote, raises the honor of the true religion among the people. But please underscore that sentence. He makes the Torah's laws the law of the state. No separation, ultimately. Religion, in turn, serves the state because it creates a basis for a kind of social ethics and instills the beliefs in people that make it possible for them to live together. Avi Ravitsky has a wonderful formulation for this, right? He says in a few places in his writing, Maimonides understands politics in starkly religious terms, but to the very same extent, he understands religion in starkly political terms. This creates a mutual symbiosis between the two. They can't be disentangled. There are places when Maimonides carves out a small separation of church and state. When kings are corrupt and rebel against the Torah, Rambam effectively sort of says, leave them alone, because if you try to deal with them and rein them in, it's going to be destructive for everyone. So he carves out, ironically, you could say, a space free from religion precisely for kings who are totally corrupt. That does not seem like a prophetic posture, but it's sort of what the philosophical system that he's constructing needs. Now, the flip of that is that in the Messianic era, of course, the king will enable both tikkun haguf and tikkun hanefesh, the repair of the body and the repair of the soul, or perfection of the body and perfection of the soul. And so the Messiah will embody in one person, melech, navi, king and prophet, ruler and wise man, politics and theology. In other words, he will be a kind of reiteration of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, Maimonides does hold the dream, as many medievals do, that one day, kind of after the Messiah comes, and there is an international community living in peace, the sphere of politics will be rendered superfluous altogether. Who needs politics when everyone gets along beautifully?
There's a couple questions. One is, how would one recognize the Mashiach given his dual role? And the other is, does Maimonides think that this kind of king ever actually existed?
The Messiah will be a king who manages to manage the political reality of Israel so skillfully that there's total peace and everyone turns to the worship of God. At a certain point, it becomes obvious that he's the Messiah. As for the question of whether Maimonides thinks this kind of king ever existed, I think that the answer to that is that the closest thing to a king like this that ever existed was Moshe, who was, perhaps not paradoxically, not a king, really. But he brought together in his person all of these different roles. King and prophet, ruler and wise man, the political and the theological. I think that that's the best answer. Moshe had it, probably Yahushua had it to a slightly lesser degree. Some of the judges had it. But since then, we haven't had that. I think that's what he would say.
A couple of questions about the separation of religion and state. From Howard Freeman, isn't separation of religion and state important only when there are multiple religions in a state, not something that Jewish thought saw as optimal?
Well, as you're about, I mean, that question is wonderful because it's going to lead me right into Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, who's going to argue that the separation of religion and state is Jewishly optimal, separate from any other discussion. I think that the way that I would answer you, and I don't know if you're speaking here about the medieval world or more normatively, religion and the separation of religion and state is necessary even when there's only one religion, because now this is a non-medieval answer. When religion is allowed unchecked power, let's just say it does not bring out its best instincts. How's that for a gentle way of putting it? I mean, one of the things we see later on in the history of political thought is the realization that we don't just need to protect the state from religion. We need to protect religion from itself on some level. That we could talk about at great length some other time in some other context, right? I mean, think about just even the way in the state of Israel, the state power that religious groups have had has not brought out the best in religious life in Israel. And think about the quality of people that the chief rabbinate has evolved to have at this point. Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, Rabbeinu Nissim of Gerona. His dates, 1320 to 1376. And this really gets to the question I was just asked. In extremely stark contrast to Maimonides, for Rabbeinu Nissim, you could say that the core political idea is duality rather than unity. Is the coexistence as separate entities of religion and state. This is a perhaps surprising approach, according to which the laws that Israel shares with other nations, political laws, are superior to the Torah's laws, at least from the perspective of maintaining the political order in an imperfect world. Let me just say that again, right? This is a kind of surprising take, according to which the laws of politics shared by all kinds of peoples and nations are actually superior to the laws of the Torah, at least from the perspective of maintaining the welfare of the political order. I'm going to explain at great length what that really means and what's behind that idea. What makes it possible for the political law to be superior is a separation between Torah and rulership, Torah and Malchut, or if you prefer, you can say between the political and the sacral. This separation enables another between secular temporal law on the one hand and eternal religious law on the other. I will explain what this means. So if it sounds very abstract at this point, just bear with me, if you will. We should start out by just noting the contrast with the Rambam. For the Rambam, politics has an inherent and irreducibly theological dimension, and there is therefore no room to say that the laws of the nations are superior, because that could potentially lead to the view that the religion of the nations is superior. But for someone like Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, you can say that the laws of the nations are superior, because the laws of the nations are separate from the religions of the nations, and crucially, the laws of the Jewish polity is separate from the Torah. Now, what on earth am I talking about? Let me try to kind of make this clear. Actually, let me start by two sentences about the influence. On one level, some historians have argued that what makes Rabbeinu Nissim's contemplation of a separation of religion and state possible is that he represents a shift from someone writing in a Muslim setting to someone writing in a Christian one. In Christianity, there is no caliph who unites religion and politics. At least in theory, there are the separate realms of God on the one hand and Caesar on the other. There is a pope and there is a king, and they are not the same guy. There are also internal Jewish developments that we could talk about, the influence of people like Ramban and Rashba on the development of the Ran. We're going to leave that, okay? For Rabbeinu Nissim, what should we know about human nature to understand politics and law? For Rabbeinu Nissim, what is fundamental to the human condition is not that man is a social political animal a la Aristotle and Maimonides, but rather what is fundamental to being human is a propensity to violence, which is a kind of ineliminable aspect of human nature. In other words, the question of politics does not emerge because you and I are dependent on each other, but rather because without politics, we would destroy each other. That's kind of one side of what Maimonides was talking about, but really only one side of it. In other words, if this is helpful, Maimonides conceives of politics in Aristotelian terms. Rabbeinu Nissim anticipates a Hobbesian approach to politics, right? If it were not for political state power, we would eat each other alive. Now, the human propensity to violence is obviously a universal problem. It's not a Jewish problem, right? And therefore, the political question is a universal one. It's not a uniquely Jewish question. It's a question about the nature of being human, not about the nature of being Jewish. All people and all peoples need a political solution to the impulse to harm one another. But, so here's the thing. For that, you have the king's laws to try to rein you in. But human beings are not only political, they are also metaphysical. They need a social order for which they have politics. But they also need religious instruction and elevation, and for that they need a Torah. But those two realms are starkly separated for Rabbeinu Nissim, and one of the questions we'll have to try to understand is why that is. Here's the claim. This is really on some level the fundamental claim which outrages some Jewish thinkers, shocks some Jewish thinkers, and inspires a lot of modern thinkers to think they have more leeway in interpreting tradition for the modern world than you might be tempted to think at first. The king's law, Mishpat HaMelech, the king's law is about making the world ordered and livable. It is not based on eternal truths, and thus it can be changed by the king, altered based on circumstances and needs. Based on what the king realizes people need in order to live together, the king can change the law. The fact that the law was one thing 10 years ago, but now there's, you know, rampant murder might mean that, in fact, right, the law can change. The Torah's law, in contrast, has a purely spiritual purpose. And therefore, this is a medieval assumption that you might not all intuitively share, therefore must be eternal and absolute and unchanging. For whatever it's worth, for a medieval thinker like Maimonides, for a law to be divine, it could not be changing. There's a political law, which is dynamic and evolving, and there's the Torah law that is eternal and absolute. And what that means, according to Rabbeinu Nissim, is that in deciding matters of Torah law, there is no room for pragmatic thinking. We'll see what that means in a minute. Now, the purpose of the divine law is not to make sure that David Lowenfeld and I don't kill each other. That is not the purpose of the divine law. The purpose of divine law is to enable the Shefa, the divine flow, to dwell amidst the people. It creates a bond between God and Israel. Now, if you're confused a little bit about this, that's a good sign, because Rabbeinu Nissim here is going to argue something about Torah law that is actually quite confusing, even if also fascinating. There's a fairly frank admission on the part of Rabbeinu Nissim that the law of the Torah cannot successfully order politics in this messy world where human nature runs amok. For example, the punishments prescribed are often too weak. The demands on witnesses are too high. It's impossible to convict anyone of murder in Jewish law, basically. You need two witnesses warning you. You need to explicitly declare, in the face of your warning, I am choosing to do this anyway. I mean, the requirements are basically no one ever gets harmed. I remember, actually, the first moment I realized this was when I was, okay, now I'm, you know, dating myself and admitting what I wasted a few weeks of my life on. As I was watching the O.J. Simpson trial, I remember thinking, you know, the funny thing is that as much as Americans thought, oh, well, most Americans thought, oh, well, it's obvious he's guilty, in Jewish law, the case would have been thrown out of court in one instant. There were no witnesses. There was no hatra'ah, right? He's not convictable in any way. To that, Rabbeinu Nissim would say, yeah, that's right. That's why a Jewish society doesn't run by Jewish law. Jewish law is about something else. Now, here's the crazy claim from a certain perspective. It's not crazy, but it's a little hard intuitively to wrap your head around. True justice is defined as law that has no social function. True justice is law that has no social function. So you have this wild paradox. The claim that the Torah represents true justice and nothing less forces it to relinquish its social role and control of society and to hand that over instead to a king. The role of the Torah is to establish quote-unquote true justice. That means, by the way, that O.J. Simpson not being convicted is, according to this model, true justice. However, true justice is so lofty and so elevated that a society can't function that way. Therefore, you have this whole separate domain in which a monarch takes over and establishes a second law. Not a Torah law, an earthly political law. No different, really, comparable to the law of any nation or any people. One of the major problems in Rabbeinu Nissim's separation of powers is it seems that at the end of the day, the monarch's power is limited only by his conscience. There's not a lot that you can do to rein in a monarch who tells you that he needs to do X and Y in order to maintain the political order. But Rabbeinu Nissim wants to argue that this is not a failing of the Torah, because the Torah itself legislates that there should be another realm of law separate from the Torah. In other words, it's not that I come and see that the Torah's law is inadequate, so I say I must create a separate law from the Torah. It's that the Torah tells me that the Torah law is inadequate. And so the Torah sanctions a secular state. By the way, can you see here why some early religious Zionists who want to build a democracy read the Ran and are like, bullseye, I just hit the jackpot? Because what you have here is the claim that religion can sanction a law that is not of the religious. Religion can sanction and even give you an argument for why you need a law that is not the Torah's law. If all you had was the king's law, you wouldn't have that realm of pure justice that brings the divine overflow to live on the people. But if all you had is the Torah's law, murder would run wild. I mean, imagine Butch Pemstein functioning in a society in which you could get away with murder, right? I mean, it'd be like catastrophic for everyone involved. Now, again, note here the contrast with Maimonides. For Maimonides, the king also is permitted to operate in extra halachic ways, but only in one domain, to prevent shvichut damim, murder. Other needs had to be handled by Jewish law itself, since Maimonides worried that otherwise a new realm would emerge that competed with Torah. sound familiar, right? Maimonides, in a way you could say, is afraid that Rabbeinu Nissim will come along. In addition, as we saw, Rambam assigned religious responsibilities to the king, so separation of realms was not possible. You can put this in a very simple way in light of what I said earlier. For Rabbeinu Nissim, you can think of the Torah law as so elevated. Imagine it being pushed up so high that it can no longer grasp the reality of earthly life. Whereas for Maimonides, no, the law is also focused on tikkun haguf, the perfection of the body, right? So here's the wonderful paradox. It is the divinity of the Torah for Rabbeinu Tam that makes it impossible for it to actually successfully organize the way people live together. That, like, is a little bit enough to make you dizzy, right? It is the divinity of the Torah that makes it an imperfect tool for Olam Hazeh, for this worldly politics. I'll put it yet another way. This is probably a fifth way. The Torah's law is the ideal law, but an ideal law threatens social order. For a social order, you need a this-worldly law with all the compromises that this-worldly law makes. So the Torah needs an autonomous structure that can fix the injustices that ensue from Torah being the only law. As Rashba, who came before Rabbeinu Nissim, had already said, if we always just, this is an amazing statement, if we always just follow the laws of the Torah, Nimtza ha'ulam charev, the world would be destroyed. There is something a little problematic about this, after all, because the Torah does have, let's say, tort laws. The more you expand the power of the king, the greater the tension you're going to have between halacha and the law of the king. After all, you will have the king legislating in countless realms where halacha also has something to say. Let's talk about uniqueness of this for a minute. Rabbeinu Nissim, essentially another way of saying all this, is that the Torah's laws become sacral all the way down. And because they are sacral, they're not political. And therefore, you can have a political realm that is separate from Torah. The political sphere is universal. In other words, what makes the Jewish people different for Rabbeinu Nissim from other nations is Torah law, not the realm of appointing kings. We all appoint kings. Israelites appoint kings, and Assyrians appoint kings, and, you know, everyone else appoints kings too. Everyone needs political arrangements. That's not what makes Torah unique. In other words, politics is universal, whereas religion is particular.
So there's questions about how much the religion and secular law interact. Let's take this one from David Lowenfeld. In the Ran's concept of the world, is there a role for rabbinic courts to rule in commercial matters? Are we supposed to subject ourselves to the rule of the secular king and courts?
I would guess that if both parties decide they want that and consent to it, that's fine. But I'm not sure either one can force the other to subject themselves only to Torah law. By the way, one of the things that's a little funny about Rabbeinu Nissim is everything I've just said is sermon number 11 in the book of sermons. You can imagine Rabbeinu Nissim did not give the kind of sermons that are given in your average suburban synagogue on a Shabbos morning. This is a very complex philosophical argument that his sermon is. But it also means that, like, there are a lot of questions. I'm going to, at the end of tonight, I'm going to raise some of the objections that might be made to this, to the plausibility and coherence of this. He never, as far as I know, we don't have it in writing, if he did, goes back and fleshes out answers to the ones like David is asking, which is like, wait, what are the implications of this for that? What are the implications of this for this? We don't really have all of that worked out. We have this very radical position he's laying out, and that's what we have. I gave you substantial excerpts from Drush Yud Aleph, Sermon 11, and that we'll go from there. But I don't think the answer to your question is obvious. Are decisions handed down by the political courts subject to review by Torah law? very much no. That's exactly the point here, is that they're really separated. The king's law is not subject to religious review. And again, that's why many scholars of medieval philosophy have pointed out that the arguably the greatest weakness of the Rance theory is there's no way to rein in the king. You can't say to the king, you're running afoul of the Torah law, because he says, I know, I'm supposed to. But then what do you do when he says, I'm making this law because I'm trying to prevent murder, but he's actually making this law to solidify his own power? Where do you turn? You don't really have, this is the, I think, ultimately the greatest weakness, is that there's, it's basically like you need to assume that a king has a conscience. Well, we know that power corrupts. People don't readily give it up. So there's a kind of failing here. A shortcoming, a chink in the argument that is pretty significant. Jerry asks whether Rabbeinu Nissim's position contradicts Lo Bashamayim Hi, the idea that the Torah is not in heaven. By that, I take it you mean that he's elevating the law to heaven rather than making it not heavenly. But that's not what Lo Bashamayim Hi really means. It's about who has the authority to determine what the law is in a particular circumstance. I don't think Rabbeinu Nissim is saying there aren't poskim. There are poskim. There are halachic decision makers. Of course there are. But what they're supposed to decide is based on the pure law, not based on pragmatism. Now, some of us might say, wait a minute, that's a really problematic conception of law. Haven't we all read Ronald Dworkin? Well, no. In the 14th century, we haven't all read Ronald Dworkin. That's precisely the point. There are halachic decision makers, but what their decision is based on? Here's another way of saying, let me say it this way, if this is helpful. Religious law, Torah law is Kantian. The king's law is utilitarian. Religious law is based on what the law is. Consequences be damned. Political law is based on making sure people don't kill each other. A posek is a Kantian for Rabbeinu Nissim. That is not something that everyone would agree with. The examples of Nathan criticizing David over his secular and political actions, not that he ate a cheeseburger. Yes, I think that that is true and a fair point, except that Nathan is not criticizing David for having legislated laws badly. He's criticizing him for running afoul of basic moral law, which I assume that Rabbeinu Nissim thinks the king is not, in theory, supposed to run afoul of, right? In other words, trying to prevent the wildfire spread of murderers is a moral aim. The king is unlikely to come along and say, okay, everyone may now rob one another, because you can't live that way together. The whole point of the king having a law would be defeated by that. Again, the problem is it's not clear how to rein him in. If this was a class with homework, I would say, okay, go home and make believe you are a Zionist thinker from 1926 and a religious Zionist thinker, and tell me how you would write an essay on Rabbeinu Nissim that would develop a theory of politics. Or for that matter, tell me how you would live anywhere and not feel the need to have Torah law become the law of the state. I mean, Zionism is just an intensification of that question, but you can ask on some level, you can ask it anywhere. Rabbi Isaac Abravanel, you could say that in contrast to Maimonides, who's the major political thinker of the Middle Ages in terms of influence, Abravanel you could describe as an anti-political thinker. Both Maimonides and Rabbeinu Nissim speak in praise of the political, and both in very different ways want some version of a kind of enlightened monarchy, or, you know, and in fact, most medieval and Renaissance Jewish thinkers took a pro-monarchic stance. Remember that transition we saw from the Chumash to the Mishnah. From the Tannaitic period onwards, the pro-monarchic position actually held the upper hand in Jewish thought. And for that matter, the messianic hope was focused on a restoration of Davidic monarchy. Also, everywhere most of these medieval and Renaissance thinkers looked, there were kings. Kingship was part of its cultural surroundings, and the assumption that that's what Jewish political life would look like was simply bolstered by the reality that everyone lived that way. And even more, I don't know about even more so, but Avi Ravitsky has made the argument that in order to read the pro-monarchic position in the Middle Ages empathically, you have to keep in mind that Muslim and Christian kings were often the one who protected the Jews from the religious zealots. And so there is a kind of sympathy towards kings who are seen as, you know, the best defense against crusaders who want to kill you. So in those generations, it's really difficult to find in Jewish thought a truly anti-monarchic position, let alone one that's skeptical of politics altogether. However, the interesting thing is that one of the greatest statesmen in the history of the Jewish people also is one of the most vituperative critics of politics in the history of Judaism. Rabbi Isaac Abravanel, living in the 15th century, he dies in 1508. He's a leading figure in the Portuguese government, but then he's suspected of conspiring against the king and expelled. He then becomes a leading figure in the Spanish government, but he has the misfortune of being a Jew and gets kicked out in 1492. Finds refuge in another kingdom, the kingdom of Napoli and then Venice. And there too, he thrives economically and politically. This is a guy whose life is in many ways very blessed. And the striking thing is that he takes such an insistently anti-monarchic stand and actually is really interestingly anticipating of certain modern ideas in critiquing materialistic culture of which he thinks monarchy is a part. I'll try to explain that in a minute. For Abravanel, and this is a comment that in a way accords with a question or a rhetorical question that I saw Gloria Beeler post earlier, right? By its very nature, according to Abravanel, politics denies theology. Let's just come out and say that. If God is the ruler, you don't have kings. If God is the ruler, you really don't have governments, ideally, right? Because otherwise, says Abravanel at least, I'm not sure this is true, but you don't mean it when you say God is the ruler. In contrast to Maimonides, right, politics and theology can't be integrated. And in contrast to the Ran, they actually can't get along. You can't just separate them and say you'll both do great. Instead, they clash with each other. No political person will accept limits on her power. When people have power, and all the more so when individual persons have power, they always try to expand their power and make it stronger. The notion of giving up power is very, very hard. So, by its own inner logic, constitutional monarchy will become absolute monarchy. An absolute monarchy will in turn become despotism. You just saw in the unfolding of America that even the notion that a president is supposed to give up power, some people can't do it, right? And so they want to be absolute monarchs and despots, right? So there's this really interesting phenomena that Abravanel says. And what Abravanel is saying in a way is that like, so my point here is not to talk about Donald Trump, but his personality is a kind of on steroids version of a human impulse that is widespread, according to Abravanel. Now, surprisingly, Abravanel makes his anti-political argument by quoting the Ran. Jews are very interesting, right? How am I going to make an argument that totally undermines Rabbeinu Nissim? I'll base it on Rabbeinu Nissim. So how does he do that? He uses Rabbeinu Nissim's ideas to remove any kind of religious luster from the king. Israelite kings are secular, like the kings of all the nations. They have no Jewish significance at all. And then he turns to Rabbeinu Nissim's granting of great power to the king to bolster his claim that monarchy is inherently threatening to Torah and its laws because it can simply override them. Meaning, he turns the Ran's approach on its head. The law of the king does not coexist side by side with the law of the Torah, but is instead destined to be at war with it. In other words, Rabbeinu Nissim's separation of powers and expansions of the right of the king help Abarbanel underline the extent to which people are threatened by the arbitrary power of kings, which we already saw is a weakness in Rabbeinu Nissim's theory. Monarchy doesn't repair society. Who are you kidding? Monarchy threatens to undermine and destroy it because the king is just an unchecked, right, force. You shouldn't have kings. Kings ruin people and defy God. That's what kings are. You might even say, I've never seen any scholar say this, but I think you can say this, that in a certain way, Abravanel represents the return of the biblical critique of monarchy into Jewish political thought. This sort of like subdued thing. It gets subdued by the Mishnah, becomes submerged, and then Abarbanel comes along and says, this whole thing is madness from a religious perspective. Now, to dig a little deeper into this view, Abarbanel offers a critique of material and technical culture. In a funny way, when you read Abarbanel, you see him as like a 15th century version of Heidegger. Right? I mean, this notion that a culture of technology is going to destroy the world and it ruins people and distorts who they are. And aggressive belligerent politics are basically the sword's edge of that fundamentally messed up culture. And monarchy, in turn, is the most dangerous expression of that messed up politics. So you have this kind of materialist, acquisitive culture, which leads to belligerent politics, which culminates in having kings. And as an alternative, Abravanel offers his own vision of utopian politics, part theocracy, part anarchy, part expressing a longing for a charismatic leader from times past. Short of that messianic utopia, Abravanel says, your goal has to be a realistic politics that distributes power among as many power centers as you can so that they rein each other in. Just spread it out. What you do with power is make people share it. But you certainly don't have a king. Having a king is a crazy idea, not to mention a blasphemous one. Again, it's totally fascinating that this is a person who spends his life, you know, in the inside of king's palaces and then comes to this conclusion. Let me now, if I can, go back to Rabbeinu Nissim. I hope this makes sense. Let me go back to Rabbeinu Nissim and say a couple of more things about him and see if this helps us think a little bit more deeply about him. According to Rabbeinu Nissim, the judge is told to judge with righteous judgment, mishpat tzedek. The Ran thinks that mishpat tzedek is deontological judgment. It is judgment based on what the law is, the consequences be damned. But the king, in contrast, is asked to constantly think in utilitarian or teleological terms for how will what the law is affect how people live together. Now, if you're a convinced utilitarian, you might say, wait a minute, I think the political law is better than the Torah law. But if you're a utilitarian all the way down, Rabbeinu Nissim will tell you, well, you're simply wrong, right? Ultimately, there's a higher level at which Kantian rule following is the highest form of morality for him. Put differently, judgment is commonly based on two very different and sometimes irreconcilable aims. One is true justice, but the other is political order. And sometimes true justice undermines political order rather than serving it. Put it differently, true justice is based only on what the defendant deserves. Political justice, political order, is based on what the society needs. So in a certain situation, a murderer might deserve to be acquitted, but a society might need him to be found guilty. It might be that the laws of politics are stricter than the laws of Torah. Biblical law resolves this tension between Kant and utilitarianism through the separation of powers. You simply have two legal systems operating at the same time. Already people before Rabbeinu Nissim had said the need to have political order, tikkun medini, means that you sometimes legislate in ways that directly and consciously, intentionally contradict Talmudic law. You cannot have a society that operates in reality based on the Torah's view of the laws of Shfichut Damim, for example, the laws of murder. You can't do that. In other words, the judicial branch is totally separate from the executive. Now, Rabbeinu Nissim does this completely beautiful thing. He offers a magnificent reading of the Shmuel story. And he says, the people in the days of Shmuel did not sin in wanting a king. They sinned in wanting a king who would be in charge of the judicial branch. They asked for a king who would be shofet b'neihem. And that was what made Shmuel crazy, is that they rejected the separation of powers itself mandated by divine law and wanted the king to have kind of an all-encompassing role. Rabbeinu Nissim's system places limits on the power of the king, but also places limits on the power of the judges and other political functionaries. The king can overrule the judges. For example, he can kill a dangerous serial killer where there were not two witnesses or proper hatra'ah warning. But the prophet, at least in theory, limits the power of the king in that the king must obey the prophet. Must, but no one can force him really. That's now me talking. The king can override the judge, but the prophet, at least in theory, overrides the king. The judges, however, limit the prophets because it is judges in their legal framework who get to decide who's a true prophet and who's a false prophet. Also, the judges determine the law without interference from the prophets. So each branch of the government is checked and checks. The king checks the judges and is checked by the prophets. The judges check the prophets and are checked by the king. And the prophets check the king and are checked by the judges. Are you dizzy yet? Right? The king checks the judges and is checked by the prophets. The judges check the prophets and are checked by the king. The prophets check the king and are checked by the judges. It's not totally symmetrical because in theory, he thinks power should be tipped in the direction of the judges. He affirms, at least in theory, the primacy of the judicial branch over the executive branch. Although in practice, I have trouble seeing how that actually works. As I've said repeatedly, I'm just not sure how the king is effectively reined in at all. Zev Harvey, one of our most kind of astute readers of the Jewish philosophical tradition, makes the comment that in one respect at least, the Ron's position fits a liberal democracy more than a monarchy. In a monarchy, as I've been saying, it's just not clear what checks and balances effectively check the king from abusing the executive right to act on the basis of what he imagines political welfare requires. A liberal democracy inherently puts more limits on the executive. So it's almost like what Harvey is saying is, if the Ron were living at a later moment and played out the logic of his own view, he would need to be a liberal Democrat and not a monarch, because he would realize at a certain point that checking monarchs doesn't really work. It's not really a check on the monarch to say the monarch must obey the prophet. Good luck. The history of Israel, I would say, was spotted on this score. Now, there's another thing he says here that is really quite dramatic, which is kingship is not an essential quality of the king. It's something that he's granted for the sake of the general welfare. Hence, the king should see himself as a servant more than a ruler. In other words, the king is just a person who's been given a social function to play out. He's a functionary. And Ron plays around with a kind of egalitarian view of kingship. If the people want him to be king, he's king. If they do not, he loses his authority to serve. That is, Zev Harvey argues, at that point, you're basically talking about a democracy. The king is king only when it is the will of the people that he be king. But the moment the people withdraw their will that he be king, he's no longer king. That's called the president. So Harvey is making this really intriguing argument that the Ron's own arguments, despite himself in a way, lead directly to the possibility of a liberal democracy. And by the way, the Ron also makes this really interesting argument, right? You know the principle in rabbinic literature, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the kingdom is the law? Rabbeinu Nissim says that only applies in Gentile lands, because there, the lands they rule are their own, and they can expel Jews who disobey. But the land of Israel is not like that. To use his language, Kol Yisrael shutafim ba. The king doesn't own Jerusalem any more than I do. And so, Dina de Malchuta Dina presupposes an undemocratic situation. Therefore, does not apply in a Jewish polity. As we may or may not see next week, as I try to figure out how to sort through this material, there are Zionist thinkers who want to argue that in the state of Israel, the reason why the law of the Knesset is binding is Dina de Malchuta Dina. The Ron would not like that at all. You can't have Dina de Malchuta Dina where all citizens are equal partners and the king is not your master, but ultimately a servant. Let me close this by talking a little bit. I've already talked about some of the key weaknesses as I see it in Rabbeinu Nissim's incredibly interesting idea of separation of powers. Again, the main one being, I'm just not sure how the king really gets checked in his system. Let's talk about this notion of Torah law for a minute. Are the Torah social laws also divine? Its vision in Devarim, for example, of how you organize a society? If those laws are part of society, are part of the Torah's divinity, then why isn't the Sanhedrin given a greater role in fixing the social realm, at least to the same extent of the king? Meaning, the Torah does seem to be interested in how people live together concretely. What do you mean when you say that the social legislation of the Torah is purely divine and has no applicability in the earthly realm? What are you really saying when you say that? What are those laws? And if judges ruling in accordance with absolute justice, quote unquote, mishpat tzedek, don't consider the realities of life in this world, then what is it about Torah law that is actually justice? In what sense is absolute justice just? Meaning, if absolute justice, quote unquote, frees murderers left and right, what do you mean when you say that's absolute justice? Absolute justice is that 99.9% of murderers get off? Why? Explain. You're saying a society can't function that way. But isn't the definition of justice about enabling people to live together? This is what I meant, what I was hinting at when I said earlier, is that all of the Torah's laws are made sacral. In some sense, they're really depoliticized. Absolute justice is not really concerned with justice, as far as I can tell. It's concerned with something else. Or at least I think that's right. And to say what may be the same thing again, and here I'm directly borrowing from Menachem Lorberbaum's writings on Rabbeinu Nissim, when you emphasize, you don't just kind of say, but you emphasize the right of the king to override the Torah's laws, you open the door to the possibility that halakha will not participate in any way in the conduct of social and political life. Or for those of you who are, you know, intense learners of halakha, what on earth is supposed to happen to Choshen Mishpat in the Rabbeinu Nissim system? The parts of Shulchan Aruch that are about how we live together. What happens to all of that? One thing, by the way, that this does that may be helpful for some liberals is the notion of a halachic state becomes an empty concept. It simply makes no sense at all. Halachic state does not belong on earth. Halachic state is absolute law, which cannot govern a society. You can't have a society governed by halacha, says Rabbeinu Nissim. He's not some 21st century liberal merits party voter, right? He's saying from a Torah perspective, you can't have Medinat Halakha. That's a contradiction in terms. Now, Jerry Blitzstein makes the point that I have been trying to make much more eloquently than I, and I want to sort of close this with a kind of like his articulation of the challenge and the chink, if you will, in Rabbeinu Nissim's armor. We may feel uneasy about the potential of this doctrine, which can so easily be used to justify virtually any abuse of centralized power. Detachment of the real from the ideal is a dangerous step. We almost sense a Machiavelli waiting in the wings. In other words, a king without scruples can take this system and render it totally moot and just run wild. So there's something very, very powerful that we're offered by Rabbeinu Nissim here, which is the possibility that from a Torah perspective, we need a non-Torah law. And so for a kind of liberal modernity, Rabbeinu Nissim becomes a really interesting resource, you know, for those for whom it is not adequate to say, well, we've learned in modernity that we need separation of powers. For those for whom you need a classical Jewish argument to validate a modern political structure. Or perhaps you can say, for those for whom participating in a modern political structure seems religiously problematic without a religiously grounded argument for it, Rabbeinu Nissim is your guy, arguably, who's basically saying, yeah, halakha doesn't pretend to be a law that society is based on. That's not even what it is. And we've seen, I hope, quoting from Lorberbaum, some of why that's so problematic, because it's just not clear what absolute justice means in that system. But there is something very promising here. And yet, again, there is also the danger of the monarch who runs wild. So I'm interested in Andrew Hoffman's comment, which is just the one that my eyes seized on for a minute. The most unique feature of monarchy is the expectation of dynasty, that your son child would inherit the throne. Most monarchs aren't chosen or granted, they are inherited. I think if I understand him correctly, Rabbeinu Nissim wants to radically relativize that. Dynasty is dependent on consent. But that's at least how, in my initial readings of that drasha, that's what I would be inclined to say that his view is. Meaning, Andrew, your description is a descriptive kind of analysis of how monarchy in fact works. Rabbeinu Nissim is offering a prescriptive vision of how monarchy works, and the king is being demoted in a certain way. Demoted from being a ruler with a capital R to a servant ruler, if you will, who depends on the people. And I think we're going to see someone like Ruff Cook, for example, is going to say in the 20th century, well, if there's no king, then the power returns to the people and they get to decide what they want. And all of a sudden, Rabbeinu Nissim becomes a kind of, right, a path towards a quasi-democratic way of thinking.